Hello, welcome to the Tezcast, the Tezos podcast. My name is Kevin Marabi. I haven't recorded an episode in literally years, and there are reasons for that. Mostly, I was working on my own Tezos projects. I've been just as devout to the Tezos ecosystem as I ever have been, but just moving into different avenues. So podcast is a lot of work. You got to do a lot of editing and stuff, but maybe that's the other reason as well. I think I was overthinking it. So I'm going to be more frequent with these. I'm not going to overthink it because, you know, I have actually been doing audio commentary information on Tezos for all this time. If you've followed me on Clubhouse or on Spaces, on Twitter Spaces, X Spaces, you are probably familiar with me and a lot of the Tezos info rooms and spaces, recordings that I have done. So yeah, but I do believe that the podcast is the best distribution outlet. So yeah, getting back into it. And because I'm getting back into it now after all this time, and because I believe we're headed into a bull market now, that we should probably start with a bit of a reboot. A reboot in the sense of maybe the show should have a reboot, but also I should introduce Tezos again to people. If you're listening to this, you're probably just someone interested in Tezos to some degree. Maybe you come from the trading world. Maybe you're interested in Tezos as a coin. Maybe you're genuinely interested in what makes Tezos unique as an ecosystem. Or maybe, and I'll get more into this, if you came in the last couple of years, you think of Tezos as an art community and an art ecosystem, which is a very interesting and unexpected development that has emerged. But it's a wonderful development as well. So what is Tezos? And I think that's a very important thing to explain, and also in the context of why are so many of us here. A lot of people are surprised at just how many people are in the Tezos community, active and diehard, despite what might be a relatively lower market cap from other L1s, those that are very highly marketed and follow the hype cycle much more closely, that the weight of the community and concern in Tezos is so much greater than that market cap would suggest. I think that that should be said. And what drove so many of us to come to it in the first place, and let alone stay through all these years? And why do people who come to Tezos become very, very into Tezos? I think that's important to explain. So fundamentally, there is this idea called on-chain governance. And that is an instrument of Tezos that I really feel it is the core of its existence. On-chain governance is something that is very much apart from the kind of governance that we've seen in blockchains before Tezos. So the governance of Ethereum, the governance of Bitcoin. And this is not to slam any other blockchain, far from it. I can talk about later how having so many blockchains out there, having a multi-chain world, helps the world a lot better, helps innovation, and is good for Tezos as well. But something very unique about Tezos is this thing called on-chain governance. So other blockchains have a fork-based governance system in which upgrades are decided by people who are either a part of maybe a corporate team or a decentralized group of people, but ultimately there is some sort of a curation as to say, okay, this is the path, this is the strategy for this blockchain, that's how we're going to go forward, and they'll fork the blockchain and say, hey, everybody come to this fork, all the validators switch over to this fork because this is the future. And then maybe that would be condoned by some of the larger corporate interests that are building on that blockchain, that fork would be, or the foundation behind that blockchain would, or the founder would exercise their influence to say so. And sometimes that's in dispute. I mean, the two original co-founders of Ethereum, they couldn't agree forward on a path forward. And Charles Hoskinson, who couldn't agree with Vitalik Buterin, he went off and made Cardano. Cardano started as a massive hard fork of Ethereum. And I wonder just how much more ahead and how unique and different Ethereum would be today if all of that talent did not leave Ethereum, but stayed on board. And Cardano, how much more advanced would it be if it had the power of and the contribution of all of those who had continued with Ethereum over the years? But the, I mean, that's a big one. But there are also other many, many small hard forks and just turnover of teams that had been contributing to Ethereum that because they couldn't direct the chain in the way that they would like to have seen it gone, they had to go and make their own project. So that's good in some ways because you get innovation that you wouldn't otherwise get. Fragmentation in that sense can bring a lot of innovation that you wouldn't have otherwise seen. But also you lose so much because you lose that cohesiveness. And in many hard forks, the communities fracture and fragment as well. So it's hard to build a momentum when you have a fork-based governance system as what had been the norm. And this had been seen as decentralized because, oh, you have the right to go on hard fork. But it's no, it's just kind of allowing for more and more centralized forms of governance and more centralized power in blockchains. So Tezos had a very different idea, the idea behind Tezos was very different, to say, let's have on-chain governance. Let's instead have a system in which individual participants, validators of the network, can submit their own proposals and other participants, other validators can vote on that. And the debates happen on-chain. You can deny a proposal, you can pass a proposal, but in the end, it's coming from the groundswell of the community, not from some corporate interest, not from some individual team or founder. The idea is that it's from everybody, and it should be competitive, just like a commonwealth is competitive. Now, let's say you submit a proposal and it's denied. In other blockchains, something like that would like, oh, well, can't get what I want done here, so I should fork. I should make my own blockchain effectively. And then you have that problem of just creating smaller and smaller extremes and smaller and smaller centralized forms of governance, smaller and smaller blockchains that have forms of governance that are more and more centralized. But in Tezos, it's like, okay, well, my idea was denied, but you know what? It was the right one. And they'll see over time. So they're going to go this way. I told them to go that way. And if you are right about it, then people will see that over time. That's the idea. You know, you can keep lobbying. You can keep saying that this is the right idea. And maybe your political power, you know, your political influence will grow over time. And maybe your idea would be adopted in the future or something like that. Or, you know, maybe you were wrong. And you might see that over time and say, oh, well, it's a good thing we have this on-chain governance thing, because if it had just followed my directive, or if I had made a blockchain under my individual directive, that would have been bad. So, you know, you have to also yield to the consensus as in you know, sometimes they're right, sometimes they're wrong. But in the long run, they're right. The consensus is right. And you are a part of that consensus as well. So that's what Tezos is, a true digital commonwealth. Now, that's the mechanism, but the consequences of this are far more profound. The fact that we stay united is a very big deal. It's a big deal on an ethos level, sure, on a principle level, sure. But when it comes to even like big business and financial institutions, I think it even matters a lot more. So I'll be very specific about this. After the Ethereum merge, it was a hard fork, but they called it a merge. JP Morgan put out a memo that was a bit kind of freaking out that there was still a large remainder of the community, of the Ethereum validator community, that was sticking with proof of work. And the headlines were reading, Ethereum is now far more centralized or far less decentralized after the merge, or the concerns about the chain split and asset splits. And that's the other thing that happens. It's not just the blockchain that splits. It's the fact that the assets that are all built on it, whether that's, yes, the ETH itself, but also the tokens and the NFTs, they're now split into two blockchains. And, you know, if you are an account holder, you have an Ethereum wallet, well, now you have two wallets on two different chains. And what many people have done, just like they did in 2016, 2017, with the splits, with the chain splits for Bitcoin and Ethereum, selling assets on one chain, so maybe they could buy the assets on the other, or buy more assets on the other, or selling them on both sides. it does create a sense of confusion as to, wait, which chain is the real one? And therefore, which assets are the quote unquote real one? And who owns the real asset? You can't really answer that question because the answer is totally subjective. It's not whatever's the majority chain and what's the minority chain, because really all hard forks start as a minority. Sometimes over a long period of time, as we saw with the Bitcoin and Cash splits, there's a flippening as to what the majority is. And then what we all, for all intents and purposes, what we call that chain changes over time. But also it's not for any court to litigate. I mean, it's completely subjective. That's the idea here. It's validators collectively deciding, all right, this is the one we're going with, and other validators saying we're going to go with the other one. So that's really bad for institutional finance, particularly for their actuaries that are putting risk on a quantitative level and saying, well, wait a minute, we can't say that this asset has value, or that there is an indisputable way of determining that this asset is this asset, because if there are splits, then someone can come along and say, no, you're operating on the wrong chain this whole time. Or because a bunch of developers couldn't agree with each other, now that chain is two chains. It becomes a very big mess. And it's not like traditional finance, in which there is a definitive authority as to, okay, here's this company. There is an official basis as to saying, okay, who runs it? You can have a vote within amongst shareholders and all of that. If somebody, for whatever reason, says, you know what, the shareholders voted against me, but I still feel I'm the authority here and I have that moral advantage, and, you know, or maybe they'll change their mind over time. Well, the court will decide, no, this is what, based on the instruments of governance that we have established in our country, this is how it works. And this is the authority. You can't do that with blockchain. So if you have self-governance, you do have to have a unified form of governance, and that's what Tezos brings. That's what on-chain governance is. So it brings that actuarial certitude to institutions, as well, in as much as it does bring this ethos of decentralization and decentralized governance and intellectual inclusion from all over the world. That's key to Tezos. That's fundamental to what it is. That's why we believe in it so much. And also, it's led to so many other things in that, you know, when you don't have to worry about internal divisions and hard forks like that, you can start to include, look at other blockchains and say, hey, that Z saplings thing is pretty cool on Zcash. Why don't we bring that over here? And so some people from Zcash came over and then they decided to contribute that in proposals and advise on those proposals. That Tender Mint thing on Cosmos, that's pretty cool. So there were those Cosmos core developers that contributed that over to, that came to Tezos later. The diaspora from that came to Tezos, and then they contributed that into what became Tender Bake. So the point is, we can keep doing this. There used to be a sort of unofficial tagline that we had circulating on Twitter in the Tezos ecosystem, or Tezos Twitter, that was, your blockchain is our testnet. And it's not a slam against other blockchains, but it's just kind of a way of referring to this, which is like, look, we can look at other blockchains, celebrate the things that they innovate, and include that, if we want to, in as much as our own original innovations, into Tezos. When you don't have to worry about hard forks and those divisions, you can create this wonderful, very inclusive, advanced technology. So that's why our forward-looking path with Tezos is, we will always have the best technology. Maybe, there will be times when we won't see that, but because we're going to have this massive longevity, we can always look at the incremental modular or even the radical advances that we see in the at-large blockchain ecosystem, and we can include that. We can include those advances. We can bring it into the fold, bring those advances into the fold. So that's very cool. That's a very cool thing. And it also gives a sense of comfort of knowing it's like, oh, well, we see that blockchain does this. It's like, if that goes well, we'll consider bringing that into Tezos. We can do that. So we're really into the long run here. And also, so many of us that came into Tezos in the beginning, we weren't, it was this common sense of, the common collective sense from all of us, I've noticed, and I felt that way too, which is that, 2017, 2018, Tezos blockchain launched in 2018. it wasn't this idea that, oh, blockchain's going to be in everything and everything is going to have blockchain in the next 2 to 3 years, which some people thought. And so then they were chasing very quick gains with their blockchain ecosystems. But in those of us in Tezos were like, well, no, it's going to, you know, you got to think in terms of 10 years. And if that's the case, well, then don't spend money on crazy marketing or give out grants like they're just without any thought or reason to them. Which, you know, like we saw that, you know, EOS was doing all that because it didn't matter then. So let's build the proper infrastructure, the proper governance. Let's get that right. And technologically, let's build a proper basis, a proper canvas here that we can continue to advance and scale this thing infinitely. So we can think about the next 100 years. So that's the fundamental difference between the mentality behind Tezos, what it offers, what it continues to offer, and where those of us diehards, where we see it going and why we're so confident about it. So I think it's just a matter now of making sure that everybody knows that about us. And that, in fact, that there is no us, that us is everyone. That's how we think of it. And at any point you come into the Tezos ecosystem, you're welcome to be here. And people get so much love and kindness and support from the ecosystem when they come in. That's also a really great and wonderful thing. Now, the other thing is that approach is also reflected in nonprofit institutions that some people would think of as the kind of central institutions that, you know, even though they're not, drive Tezos forward, namely Tezos Foundation. Tezos Foundation is not like other blockchain foundations. They're very hands-off in a good way. And maybe to some people, even to a fault, they're so hands-off. But, you know, what they've done is over the past, since 2017, has been to just grow these ecosystem funds, manage that treasury, and write grants. That's what, you know, that's about like 98% of their activity is that. And it's because of that, which is, again, very different from other foundations, other ways in which blockchain ecosystems we've seen run even through today, it evolves a sense of empowerment to the members of the community, to the individual, lowly, for lack of a better word, individual, independent members of the community, in which they feel that they have an impact in what they do, in a manner that they wouldn't necessarily see it had the ecosystem been so centralized and run from a top-down manner. You know, you wouldn't even necessarily think to do, like, I wouldn't even necessarily think to do this if I thought, like, oh, well, you know, why would I do a podcast? I'm sure Tezos Foundation has their own, right? No, nobody thinks that. Or people think, like, oh, I should run my own local Tezos event. That's how it works. It's not like you have to expect planning, and you shouldn't expect planning in that manner from the Tezos Foundation, because that's not what they do at all. All the greatest successes in the Tezos ecosystem have come from the grassroots, independent, individual initiative level, from the most successful dApps and platforms and marketplaces that have been developed, to the greatest, let's call it, for lack of a better term, onboarding activities that have brought in so many people. And I'll talk more about that. You know, it's just come from these individual independent initiatives. So, and that's also the best thing for any kind of innovation as well, because, you know, if it is top down, you're ultimately limited in as much as you're limited in how much you can advance the technology of the blockchain, to how good of a job you could do. Even if you have the best, smartest, most capable team in the world, or the best, smartest, most capable founder in the world, they're ultimately limited. There's only so much they can do. And also there's only so many hours in a day. And also, you can't throw money at every problem and expect it to solve that problem. And you can't throw money at crafting solutions and expect them to be at all effective, let alone better than what someone could, you know, burning the midnight oil because they truly have a passion for this and they truly believe that the fruits of their labor will be seen and not steamrolled by something very centralized that will come and do it in a very quote-unquote official manner. That's another really beautiful, wonderful, incredible thing about Tezos. And you don't always see that reflected in maybe the loudest comments you might see on social media, because there are those who will always, and I think it's just part of human psychology, to, in times of distress, particularly, you know, in a bear market, to go and blame and find faults and criticize someone central or something that's central. Find an individual or an institution that you see as an authority and say, this person or this thing isn't doing their job. Well, is it really up to them to begin with? And if it were, is that a good thing? So for one thing, the Tezos Foundation gets far too much credit in times good, you know, when it's not them and it's not things that they've done. And I could speak to very specific examples of this. And far too much blame in times bad, you know, as well as the founders of the ecosystem who, by the way, set this ecosystem up to be decentralized in that manner, to benefit from the contributions of the many. But you know, we just have this tendency as humans to always look for someone in charge or something in charge to give them too much blame and too much credit, even when the whole Tezos culture, that which is Tezos in every sense, is designed to be not that, far from that. So yeah, and I'll get into more specifics. And I want to, that leads into something else, which is since Tezos began, what we call Tezos, or when you say the word Tezos, those who are in or adjacent to the ecosystem, they perceive, I'd say, there are three distinct groups of people and three distinct meanings or definitions in their perception, in those respectively, as to what Tezos is. For those of us who are the OGs, those who are, you know, build on Tezos, who are part of the Tezos community, who maybe they hold Tezos events, to us, we see this large blockchain ecosystem defined by this thing called on-chain governance. And it's these collective contributions from all over the world. It's a movement. That's what Tezos is. It's this movement, it's not simply a blockchain. It's beyond that. You know, or maybe they see some like subset of that as, you know, like you're a core developer. To you, Tezos is that blockchain technology, but as a function of this broader ecosystem. And for others, I noticed around, you know, ever since the very beginning, since Tezos came on the market as a, or in trading markets, as a token, XTZ, which is the symbol of Tezos in blockchain crypto trading sites. So to them, when you say Tezos, they just think about that coin, or they think about that price. They think about the market cap of it. They think about its movement. They think about that technical analysis. To them, that's what it is. And quite literally, they'll describe, it's like, oh, you're from Tezos, huh? So you guys are at, you know, some dollar and something cents. Like, what? Oh, you're talking about the coin. So to them, it's a very superficial definition, and it's really just referring to it as an instrument of monetary gain or loss, in as much as they think of any stock or any or Bitcoin itself. And maybe this comes from Bitcoin just being such a strict system of either of money, of a store of value, something that people trade, in as much as it's being the first blockchain. But Tezos is not like that. It's, you know, and nor are any of these very smart contract centric ecosystems. Yes, they might have a native currency to it, and maybe that currency trades on the market, and from that you can derive some sense of valuation by, you know, multiplying the average market price with circulating supply. But that's not what it is. That's not the defining aspect. Yeah, sure, it's very important. Of course it is. But it's not how everybody thinks of the ecosystem. And maybe that's how someone can, maybe you should find even more value in that. The fact that like there is this massive community of people who see it as something greater, far greater than a simple coin or currency. And then there's something that emerged in early 2021. And I feel I was very fortunate enough to be on the ground level of watching that blossom. And that is an NFT art community, an art community that formed around the Tezos ecosystem at that time. And in terms of numerical strength, in terms of activity, and in terms of just even using the word Tezos, there were far more people, and still today, that are in that aspect, in that branch, in that specific usage of the term, than either of the first two, which is incredible and not something any of us expected. And I want to refer to what happened in that time, because it's just so unique and interesting, and I never saw a cultural shift in my life before or after. It was incredible. So back in late 2020, you started to see NFTs get more and more popular. You started to see artists get on board and try out these marketplaces like OpenSea and Foundation and Zora and things like that. And they were all on Ethereum. Wax and EOS did the NFT thing, I think, before they really started to take off as much as they did on Ethereum. But it was more centered around collections and also Flow and those things. But they're more about like collections and kind of like the trading card a way of looking at NFTs. They weren't the idea of fine art and artists coming in and making a living on a blockchain doing NFTs. As an alternative or in addition to how they marketed their art and distributed their art before that, that was not something that was foreseen. It took a while to get there, but it started to take off like crazy. And I think there were timing considerations with that. I think COVID being everybody being inside, I think Clubhouse as an app, but this is before Twitter Spaces became a thing, offering people the comfort of audio chat and the trust that was that came in from people learning about things and new technologies from audio chat. That was a very big and underappreciated part of it. But yeah, the artists from left and right were coming into blockchain to make their NFTs. But what happened was the success of this and OpenSea becoming the top most utilized contract on Ethereum, and just the sheer volume of people coming in, it led gas prices to skyrocket on Ethereum. It got to the point where you were spending hundreds of dollars on gas on a transaction on Ethereum. And this is by, you know, the first few months of early 2021. That's what you had to do if you wanted to do it. That's where the fine art NFTs were. They were on OpenSea. They were on these Ethereum NFT marketplaces. And at that time, you know, Solana wasn't ready yet. It had for smart contracts. It had several more months to go. Same thing with Polygon, several more months to go before they launched their network. But Ethereum was the way to do it. It was just so like there wasn't a question of if there were alternatives. It was just Ethereum. But in that time and in 2020, Tezos became capable of facilitating these NFT smart contracts in that we had a framework that came out called OpenMinter, and it was open source, and people started to do these little experiments with it. There was someone, a college kid in Brazil, his name was Rafael Lima, and I believe he participated in a hackathon. He got a very tiny grant. I think it was, you know, just very probably maybe, I don't know why I want to say 1500, but something around that neighborhood, just a very small, small grant. And I think he was planning to build a marketplace on Solana. This is how I recall it. But it wasn't ready for it. So, you know, frustrated with that, he decided one day, you know what, Tezos is ready for this now. So he put out a marketplace called Iketnunk. And some people remember it as Hen or Hick, which is still around and still technically the smart contracts are or popular. And I'll get into what the story of how that happened. Iketnunk is something he created in the beginning of March, I'd say March 1st, 2021. And very quickly, this thing started to take off. This is an NFT marketplace that was built on Tezos. Now, suddenly you didn't have to pay hundreds of dollars for gas just to get going. It was less than a penny in gas. So there was a viable alternative to Ethereum NFTs. This was not the case before. Also that month came out, Calamint came out, which was more a curated marketplace in the sense that, you know, it wasn't just the free, just open to mints as Ikit Nunc was. So there was less activity there, but it was instrumental as well. But Ikit Nunc was what took the world by storm. And, you know, long story short, within six weeks of launching, Ikit Nunc had more users and transactions than every Ethereum NFT marketplace combined. And it was all rooted in fine art. And it was so inclusive of the whole world. I mean, it's not just that it was expensive to do it on Ethereum and to do it on OpenSea. It's the fact that, well, you know, the 99.9% can't afford it. It's a no-go, you know? And it's not like people like, okay, they just get started. And then even if they're making money right away, or they expect to make money right away, is you still, you know, have to go in and kind of experiment a little bit before you get comfortable. But yeah, that's what Ikit Nunc enabled. So, and the thing is, if you asked anybody in the Tezos ecosystem before March 2021, what do you think of NFTs and the future of that on Tezos? I can't imagine no one would have said like anything but, oh, that's cute, but who really cares? Like, or that's a fad. And people were looking more towards the DeFi as being the first killer ecosystem that we should concentrate on, and not just speaking for myself. I'm speaking for, you know, just that would be the typical word on the street in the Tezos ecosystem. So it wasn't until we started to see that the vast majority, like 67% of transaction calls in March, were to Ikit Nunc that people were like, oh, okay, this is a very big deal. And again, so no marketing was done, nothing from Tezos Foundation. And some people are like, oh, no, I saw some marketing of this. I read that. No, that came later. This was all just totally organic. People were minting on Ikit Nunc. They would post it on Twitter and then others would see it. They wanted that content and they said, oh, how do I get this? And then they would want to go on Tezos. But not only that, the other big thing, again, as I mentioned, was Clubhouse. So I was on Clubhouse at that time. And, you know, this is audio chat. And, you know, before Ikit Nunc came out, before that month, I saw the NFT rooms, but I didn't really go into them. I started going into them and I noticed it was all just basically, you know, there'd be thousands of people in these NFT tips rooms, but it all felt just like group therapy for gas fees. People just kind of wishing they could participate in this NFT thing, but they couldn't. And it got to the point where I was like, okay, this is kind of ridiculous. I mean, there's this alternative out here and I don't want people to think like, oh, you're shilling for Tezos or what, but it's like this, come on. I mean, these people really want an alternative. I never felt more validated to just actually talk about a product. You know, I'm not part of it. I'm not part of like that, the marketplace of Ikit Nunc or Calamint. So, you know, I had nothing personally to gain for it other than, I guess, just the at-large growth of the Tezos ecosystem. And so I started saying, it's like, you know, there's this, you can know this thing called Ikit Nunc and, you know, there's Calamint and, you know, you can come in through that. And I remember the moderators would often like kick me down and they would say, no, like literally kick me down into the audience because they didn't want to let me talk. And because they're like, what is this thing? What is this, some kind of scam chain or whatever? But every time I did that, even if I only got to get a word in for like 2 seconds, I would get literally dozens of people DMing me on Twitter and Instagram, because Clubhouse didn't have DMs at the time, saying, what was that thing you were talking about? What was that thing that was like, you said it was less than a penny to mint? What was it called? And then I made this thing again in March 2021 called Tezos.art, just as a website, which was a free directory, no trackers, no referral, anything, to just let people know, here are the wallets you can get, here are the marketplaces, here's, you know, what you can do, here are the reasons why people like Tezos. And tools for developers and social connects and all of that. And I feel safe in saying like I was the first one to do it, because I was, not only was I going around and I wasn't seeing anybody else talk about this, but also, you know, these mods of these rooms would tell me that. But it was so new. And, you know, that was my little part in just trying to seed this thing on Clubhouse at the time. I had no idea that I was sitting in the epicenter of where all artists were like directly finding out about NFTs and what to do. The most artists were, and I didn't even know who I was talking to most of the time, that I, like, oh my God, you're saying that was one of the biggest artists in the world? I didn't know. Because how much did I know about art? Like, you know, very little. But yeah, and very quickly, those people who are, I would be talking to and maybe personally onboarding them, you know, and walking them through the process, they would start their own onboarding rooms, which was nuts to me. It's like, oh, that's so cool. Like, I taught you and then you're teaching other people. And then they would get really into it and they would systematically do it. And you'd see hundreds of people in those onboarding rooms. And maybe somebody would come up and say, hey, can you help me get onboarded? And then hundreds of people would be in the audience saying, you know, just following along and doing it too. And to the point that very quickly, all NFT rooms on Clubhouse by April were Tezos rooms. I could not find an Ethereum room. And you could say, yeah, it's the economics had to do with that. I mean, one thing costs less than a penny and everyone seems to be doing it. And then this thing costs hundreds of dollars a transaction. Why would you do that? So we saw the most rapid period of growth in Tezos at that time. No marketing, totally organic. Iket Nunk didn't do any marketing. Raphael was very averse to that. It was just letting it all happen organically. And, you know, he was still in college. I mean, that was the other thing. This was the quickest, and not just the most rapid period of growth in Tezos history, but the most rapid period of growth in anything I had ever seen or been a part of. Tezos.art is still up there today, so people can check that out if they like. So it was a very, very interesting and fantastic time. And I have met people and made relationships in that period of time that I still have today. And we saw a sense of loyalty grow. I remember from many of those Tezos art OGs that has just continued to blossom and prosper over time. And it's led to so many great things. We've seen so many artists from all ends of the art world come in, from just, I feel, people who are maybe unrecognized and unappreciated, but they were great artists that just couldn't have their work seen because they're from parts of the world where resources are limited, and then suddenly now they can participate in this ecosystem and get recognized and get paid and you know, make a living. I mean, so many people were able to make a living off of this. Two celebrities, we saw Val Kilmer and Vincent D'Onofrio, from ushered in from people like Lawrence Fuller to come in. We've seen art events all over the world, from Proof of People in London to Stellar Powered by Tezos by Victoria West, and just so many things, and so many great, I feel, teachers of Tezos that came in that time. People like Andressa Ferletti and Chris DeShane, and just so many others. I don't want to leave people out. But and we also had that summer the Hickathon, which was something that was put on by Iket Nunk. And so many developers who then went on to make more NFT marketplaces and tools came from that virtual hackathon that had been happening at that time. And then we saw a site come out called Object.bid. Object is what we called what NFTs and listings were called on Iket Nunk. So they made a site called Object.bid, which then became Object.com, which is still around today. And the object was called Object.bid because it added an auction component to the object listings, to the Iket Nunk listings. And then they eventually aggregated other NFT marketplaces on Tezos, and then they made their own minting contract. And it's today, Object is the largest NFT marketplace on Tezos. We also saw that year come out FX Hash, which very quickly became the largest generative NFT art platform. But in all of this, there is a common thread in that these were not centrally planned projects. They didn't have VC backing. They were just individual initiatives made for very little money, and they just took off. And it fits so perfectly into the ethos of the art community, because the art community is very countercultural and rejecting of commercial interests and all of that. So I remember people were referring to Tezos as having a punk rock vibe, which I didn't know how to, or Iket Nunk having a very punk rock vibe. I didn't know how to take that as artists and collectors were saying it. But I at first I thought it was kind of like a diss, but then like an insult. But then I realized what they were saying. It's like, no, that's a badge of honor. That's what you want. I feel that we're still the number one blockchain for fine art. Now, there's stuff that we were missing, which was, and I'll get into this, and that was the sort of the price points, the kind of liquidity you had in Ethereum. And that was still something that was leading people to move to, you know, over to Foundation and or Super Rare, these kind of high-end curated art, art platforms. More of the curated ones, I feel, tended to be the place where, like, Super Rare and all of that. But I think definitely even those platforms took a lot of their tip, and their evolution came to be from seeing the movement and the cultural change that happened when suddenly you were able to bring in so many more people into the art world in because of these Tezos NFT marketplaces. Now, the reason why those price points were different and why the liquidity was so much more in Ethereum, and this is still the case today, it's because we first did not establish a scaled DeFi ecosystem. In fact, we didn't even have a complete DeFi ecosystem back then in 2021. In fact, the blockchain protocol of Tezos was not capable of supporting the type of dApps that were needed to complete the basic, you know, just level one of DeFi infrastructure needed to scale DeFi on Tezos. So DeFi is decentralized finance. So it's having a finance sector in the economy of Tezos. We did not have that. Whereas the summer before all the NFT stuff took off on Ethereum, they had DeFi summer then. And not only that, but they really started to grow. Like their scaling began a year before that. So you had to look to mid-2019. That's when DeFi on Ethereum started to begin their scale. It just kind of took off like crazy in the summer of 2020, but you know they were building really solid foundations since back then. So that's what's needed. Like just like any economy needs a finance sector, so did a blockchain economy. So a lot of people were just bearish, I think, even when Tezos NFTs were taking off, they didn't really see much for the future of Tezos NFTs because they said, oh, well, Tezos doesn't have a scale DeFi ecosystem yet. So how can it grow? And this was, there was some accuracy in this. Yeah, it's like, yeah, well, we couldn't grow to the point of having those price points, but you know, we were growing in terms of having those people. And I had to keep saying like, well, wait until we finish building this DeFi ecosystem and then that scales and then we'll get to that point. But I mean, you know, people, you know, so you can't really blame people for doing very well on Tezos and then they'd hop over to Ethereum to make their money, like having some very big sale and then coming back to the community on Tezos where you see this diverse world of fine art from artists all over the world that people were just attracted to and it kept reinforcing itself. It was so wonderful. But yeah, so DeFi. And it is interesting though, because here on Tezos, which, you know, and right now, you know, we're starting to scale out. It's April 2024. And it wasn't until the beginning of 2022, end of 2021, so this is long after the growth of Tezos coming from the NFT art world, from Ekit and Calum and FX Hash, those things. That's when the blockchain protocol itself was able to upgrade to even facilitate the complete set of dApps that we needed, DeFi dApps. So we had DEXs, we had decentralized exchanges, we had stablecoins. And this gets into my work a bit. We were able to create the first stablecoin on Tezos, USD Tez, a reserve-backed stablecoin. That was in May 2020. And it was so early that wallets couldn't even show off any tokens yet. Most Tezos wallets couldn't even show, because the standard hadn't been incorporated to it. And there were no DEXs. There was nothing to do with this coin. So we were just very excited. It was very early to have it. So it was us and TZBTC, which was created by a Swiss consortium. That the first DEX came out on Tezos in September 30th, 2020. And that was called Dexter. And there were just two coins on it and two pools. There were, at that time, it was XTZ TZBTC and XTZ USD Tez. And that grew organically very well over the next several months. Even through the time that, you know, we started to see the blossoming of NFT marketplaces and, but again, this is very slow. Then the second DEX came out called Kipu Swap, and that was by Madfish. And that came out in the spring of 2021. And We started to see more growth, more organic growth, and then came the yield farms in the in Tezos DeFi in 2021, and that was the summer of 2021. That was Tezos's DeFi boom because of the yield farms and people chasing a buck in that way. And we were able to bring in, go from just a few million dollar liquidity on in Tezos DeFi to over $100 million in liquidity at that time. And, you know, mostly informed by Plenty, which is a platform that came out, Plenty, first starting with yield farms and then with the DEX, as well as Crunchy. There's Salsa DAO and Spicy Swap. There's Wrap Protocol, which then got incorporated into into Plenty's overall Plenty network. But most of that TVL at one point, at least in Plenty, was over half of it at one point was in ETHTEZ and USD TEZ and ETHTEZ, which were the two coins that we had out at the time. We released ETHTEZ in the December of 2020. So we had a very firsthand look as to what was driving people to come in, of course, the yield farms, but also when people were making their redemptions of their liquidity, we were able to hear what their concerns were, what they wanted. And many would ask, is there anywhere like a Compound or an Aave, some kind of a lending platform where I can park these funds and wait for the next opportunity? And the answer was always, okay, no, the fact that the protocol isn't even ready for that. So the reason for that is the way in which Tezos was designed from the beginning to prevent a type of security concern called reentrancy attacks was Tezos was designed in a manner that would prevent that. But at the consequence, we weren't able to make things like lending dApps like Compound or Aave that easily. So more upgrades had to come in to Tezos protocol into the blockchain before we were capable of that. So that's what had to happen. So because the answer was no, you can't put your money, you can't put your tokens and your TEZ into, you can stake your TEZ, but you can't put it, the tokens into anything that's a lending platform and grow on interest and, you know, borrow against it or wait, or at least wait until the next opportunity comes along. So they'd be like, okay, well, I guess I should pull out all my liquidity from the Tezos ecosystem. So we went from $100 million liquidity in Tezos ecosystem down to under $10 million again, very, very quickly as it came in. Now, had there been lending systems available at that time, there's no doubt in my mind there would be, Tezos would have a multi-billion dollar liquidity TVL DeFi ecosystem. And not only that, but we would have seen the price points and the type of volume on Tezos that we were able to see on Ethereum NFT marketplaces. But still, despite that, we were able to retain so many users, even through the bear market, we had far better retention on Tezos in the ecosystem than other blockchain ecosystems in which the collapse was almost just complete. And that was because we had like such an organic groundswell of very localized communities of people who were following these artists, you know, that were very sincere towards them and looking at the intrinsic value of the art as opposed to what was the saving grace for the Ethereum art ecosystem by and large. It wasn't these just very curated NFT marketplaces. It was PFPs. Profile pictures that were basically collectible utilities. So people were chasing quick gains, and it started with Bored Apes and CryptoPunks, and then it led to so many CryptoPunks and then Bored Apes, and then it led to so many other copycat things like that, and people just trying to chase that gold rush. But of course, that was like very insincere. People were just chasing money. They weren't chasing anything else. And so their sincerities would flip on a dime. And so those marketplaces like OpenSea, which were not doing well for fine art anymore, by May 10th of 2021, just because of the gas prices of Ethereum, they were down to like maybe just 500 users according to Dapp Radar, and then just their volume was just maybe between two artists or something, a very small handful of artists and collectors. But their saving grace that summer was Bored Apes, Mutant Apes, and most of their activity and volume came from that. Very little going forward towards fine art, except for those that were just feeling that You know, I need the liquidity that's on the Ethereum ecosystem. But anyway, so we still did very well in terms of retention and in terms of the sincerity and groundswell of the community that was still very loyal to Tezos. So the back to DeFi. So we had those DEXs. We had AlgoCoin Synthetics, which is another critical part of the Tezos economy through Calibri and KUSD, and then Uves through with UUSD. But then by summer of 2022, Tether finally came into the picture as well. So it wasn't just USD Tez as the only stablecoin, the only reserve-backed stablecoin. Now you had Tether that was in the mix, but still no lending system. So Tezos was capable of supporting it, but it wasn't until August 2022 that my company StableTech created TezFin and the beta for it. And the couple days later, the production launch of Upana, also by the same people who made KipuSwap and Temple Wallet, Madfish, that's the team, they came out with their audited production version. So Upana had been out there, and it wasn't until, and then so iterating that, TezFin, over 2023, that was the year that was spent for us. It was just a security audit and getting it right. And by the beginning of 2024, we were able to launch TezFin, so Tezos.finance. You know, I remember in the first episode of this podcast, I said I wasn't going to mention any personal projects because I thought it sullied things, but here I am mentioning them. I guess it's kind of hard to avoid when, you know, they are part of the overall narrative. So I'm not trying to shill my own things or whatever. In fact, I'm not getting any money from this. It's just, so I'm trying to mention as many. If I ever mention anything that is a personal project, I'll try to mention all the other stuff around it, like all the other projects of and far more of them than things that I'm personally associated with. So hopefully that's the right balance. So now we have multiple lending systems in the Tezos ecosystem and Tezos DeFi, and now it's time to scale them. So once those things scale, we'll be able to see that move into not just affecting and scaling the rest of Tezos DeFi, we'll start to see the liquidity go up on Tezos decentralized exchanges. That was the case in Ethereum. It started with the lending platforms growing, and then that followed by seeing the liquidity on Uniswap start to grow. So we saw compound start to scale. Then came the scaling of things like, Uniswap. So that's how it works. And if you go and you look into maybe if you read a book like Sapiens, there's a point where he talks about this. It's the system of lending and borrowing in any kind of ecosystem, in any kind of economy, ever since the 1700s, that's what leads to growth, economic growth in all ends. Without it, you don't have this thing called credit. You don't have this thing, and by credit, I mean like financial credit. You don't have the ability to borrow capital and go on, create entrepreneurial endeavors, whether that entrepreneurial endeavor is making some play in DeFi or trading or flipping those NFTs or doing something, starting a business, let alone that money effectively initiating a money multiplier effect in which it would go back into deposits on a secondary and tertiary level and grow the amount of available liquidity to borrow again. So these decentralized lending systems are important. They create a automated interest rate that people put down collateral and then they can start borrowing. You know, if you pay back your debts, you're good to go. If you don't, you get liquidated. And by the way, all DeFi has that level of risk, smart contract risk. And also you're expected, if you participate in it, to monitor your holdings and your activities. You know, there are no bailouts here. That's what blockchain is. That's why this is not like traditional finance. This is its own thing, completely different. So that's why we're at a very interesting time and a unique time for Tezos. So DeFi is now ready for scale. And it's beginning to start to scale organically and great. And as it continues to grow, we'll start to see the growth of the commerce sector. So that's one of the unique things about Tezos. And maybe for even just for an onlooker overall, you can see, well, this is for the first time we can see a scaled and thriving commerce sector in a blockchain ecosystem before it had a scaled finance sector. Every other blockchain, Ethereum had that because that's the way it developed on it. I mean, it just DeFi took off first, and then later the discovery of fine art NFTs started to popularize. So that timing just happened to be right for them. Other things were not good, sure, like gas fees and all of that. And the other thing, but for a centrally planned blockchain ecosystems, and I'd consider things like Solana in that mix, and the Polygon in that mix, in which the entities that had a prime role in, unlike the Tezos Foundation, that a prime role in the organizing and in the proliferation of the asset and infrastructure, also had a very strong role in the planning of how stuff is going to unfold. So there was a lot of focus on getting market makers in and getting their DeFi ecosystems thriving. And then they made a big push for NFTs. Then they made that. So, if you're going to be centrally plan something, that's the right way to do it. So they did it right. So this is a very unique thing. It's like, well, what happens to the economics of the art and commerce sector once you start to bring in scale finance? It's going to be very interesting to watch, even for an onlooker. It's very interesting to watch. The other big development we had in the last year, I'd say, in Tezos is the growth of, integration of or making capable of rollups. And so what that has done is it's created the ability to scale Tezos in ways, not just quantitatively, but in methods that were never before capable in the past, and leading to things that a lot of builders have been asking for, which is EVM compatibility, Ethereum Virtual Machine compatibility. So if you're a developer who built your app in Solidity, for the Ethereum ecosystem, but you want the benefits of Tezos, through rollups, you can effectively port your app over and start writing to the Tezos blockchain and having it operate on Tezos and not have to worry about the costs and limitations associated with Ethereum layer one. So that started the demonstration of that. I remember I saw at Tez Dev in Paris in July of last year in 2023. And it was just really a demo to show off what you could do with rollups on Tezos. But since then, there's been an even bigger push to say, hey, well, maybe this should be a full-on layer two and market it as such. And so that's called Etherlink, Etherlink is that EVM layer two that writes to Tezos blockchain. So it offers very unique advantages that using Tezos as the layer one as opposed to Ethereum can give, and it gives people that EVM compatibility that they always wanted for the people who wanted to, come onto Tezos, and bring their app over to Tezos, but they built their thing in Ethereum, and that's the way they want it to be, or they want to build it in using that tooling. But even then, I think it's very important to note that if you look at the metrics of how many developers, the average active developers you have in Solidity for Ethereum versus the number of developers you have for Tezos, you'd think it would be like 100-1 or 1,000-1. No, it's 10-1, which is still, Ethereum, EVM, Solidity, that's the market leader, of course. But it's a few thousand developers as opposed to a few hundred developers on Tezos. That's not like some crazy lead when you look at the dominant programming languages and frameworks in the world, just overall. You're talking about tens of millions of people using those languages like JavaScript and Golang and all those things, and Python and all of that. So the future is really not coding anything in Solidity nor in Mikkelsen. No, it's in the languages developers are used to developing in that will compile down to those Solidity or Mikkelsen seamlessly, and the developer doesn't have to learn or do anything new. I mean, that's the lowest friction path. That's the path it's all moving towards. There are all these bridge languages. Like for Tezos, we have SmartPy for Python. We have LIGO, which is for general purpose development. So, I mean, for a developer, I mean, things are going in a direction that's removing all of those frictions as well. So, there are the short-term outlooks for Tezos. There are the sort of medium-term solutions for things, and then there are the long-term outlooks, which looks at those overall trends and seeing, you know, where the ball's going, where the puck is going. So that's Tezos. It's very hard to distill the last few years into, say, an hour's worth of content. So this is just to give a top of my head overview of where we've been and where we're going in the Tezos ecosystem. And I'd like to follow this up with a very frequent and more episodes. I'll get interviews in as well. So I'd like to thank you for joining us. And I say us because it sounds more important. Thanks for joining me. I'm Kevin Marabi, and this is the Tezcast. And have a great day.